Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 430 for December 30th, Sunday, 2012.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show. You send in your questions, you send in your tips, you send in cool stuff found. We share your tips, we share cool stuff found, we answer your questions, we share some stuff we've come up with on our own, and together, the concept is, we all want to learn a little bit something new each and every time we come here to meet every week. Here, in very, very snowy winter wonderland, Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, in less of a snowy, icy wonderland, in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
I have a beautiful view out my window. We got about 12 inches the other day, and that's all still on the ground. And then probably about 6 inches of really fluffy stuff last night that's just sort of, you know, blanketed everything. And it looks awesome. I love it. Absolutely love it. It's not fun to shovel, although the stuff from last night's not terrible. It's like I said, it's really fluffy, so easy enough.
Well, I minimize shoveling.
Do you?
Chemicals.
Well, you got to do
some little shoveling.
Get the decks and stuff.
Oh. I like calcium chloride myself. So there's also magnesium chloride and, of course, sodium.
Sodium, right. Any of the salts. Many of the salts.
Yeah, but I believe the calcium is the one that has the lowest resets the melt point, lower than the others.
Yeah. Yeah, you just got to make sure that if you have pets around that you're using something that's not going to totally scorch their paws.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. So and it also eats away at your driveway and all that stuff. So you got to, you know, use it judiciously. I have a couple of tales of well, I won't call them woe, but a couple of tales of success with iDevices, John. The first of which. So my son and longtime listeners will remember that my son who joined us on the show, Lucas, a couple of weeks ago, he's the one that has had various problems with the iPods that he's owned. His iPod Touch 4 was the one that he something weird happened with it, probably water damage, although that was never confirmed. And then he broke the screen on it. Well, he's got this iPod Touch 5 that he actually came on the show and talked about. And let's see, today's Sunday. So Friday evening, 6 or 7 PM, he picks it up off the counter. He had gotten a new case for it. And apparently this new case is very, very slippery. And he picks it up off the counter and the thing shot out of his hand like a fish and like a fish went straight for the dog bowl. Right. I mean, we've got one dog water bowl throughout our entire house and it went like beeline straight into the thing and totally submerged. It was like, you know, it's 2 months old. And he's like, oh, dude. And so the whole family like jumped into action. He pulled it out of the water. He handed it to me. I already had a towel in my hand. I like flipped the case off of it, dried it off. Meanwhile, Lisa was pouring rice into a Ziploc bag and we dumped the phone in the rice and kind of, you know, shook it around a little bit and then let it sit for until this morning, right before we came and recorded the show. But, you know, we wanted to mess with it so bad, but we also knew, you know, got to dry it out. But late Friday night, before he went to bed, I had him pull up his iPhone and we looked and find my iPhone to see if his iPod Touch came online, right? You know, if the Wi-Fi was still active, because we didn't do anything. We didn't want to touch any buttons or anything when we put it in the rice, because that's what you're supposed to do. And sure enough, it came up, you know, it showed up on the map and said it had been found and all that good stuff. And we thought, okay, good. So this morning when we got up, we wanted to give it 24 hours in rice, which meant we weren't going to mess with it till this morning. We took it out and kind of shook the rice out of the, you know, the lightning connector and the headphone jack and all of that. And it totally, at least at this point, works 100% flawlessly. There's no notable issues. And I even look, the water sensor is still white, which is great. So the lesson is if you drop your iDevice in water, get it out as fast as you can, put it in rice. And there's actually, I have some, I got to dig these out and put them in strategic places. But there was a company that sent me some like bags of silica gel or something that you were, you know, supposed to do this with. So you're not using rice because it's all dusty or whatever, but get them in there and leave them in for 24 hours. Just let that, you know, whatever it is, rice or silica gel or whatever, just absorb all the moisture out. And you want a Ziploc bag because you want the bag to be sealed so that the rice is, you know, absorbing all the water that's in the device. But good news, you know, that so far it seems to be working fine. He dodged another bullet, that kid. You with me, John?
I'm with you, brother.
All right. Well, that's good. In show 429, which would have been the previous show to this one, we talked, John, about how Google is doing away with its Exchange syncing stuff, right? And I pondered what are we going to do? You know, certainly we want to be able to connect to these things from our iDevices and all of that. Well, on Christmas Day, Lisa got her iPad mini, and we restored it from her backup of her previous, actually first gen iPad, which is what she was using prior. And so we, I restored it and but some of the stuff in her calendar wasn't appearing. And I thought, oh yeah, that's right. I got to go into the Google thing, even though it's connected via the Exchange, because that's how that, you know, backup was set up. I got to go in and tell it this new device has access to her calendars, because otherwise it just gives her access to her main calendar. And you go to m.google.com/sync. Well, when you go there, you can't edit anything anymore. Whatever settings you had previously set for your existing devices are fine. But if you get a new device, no luck. There is no way. Or if you want to change settings, or if you add a calendar and you want to go and add it to your old existing devices, no luck. Can't do it with the Exchange thing anymore, at least not that I found. So I got to learn what the real process is, and it's actually much better. We removed the Exchange, you know, calendar sync thing from her. We went in and we set it up as a Gmail account. And I've since done this on all of my devices, just, you know, even though I didn't have to, although I've got another story to tell that I did have to, but I went in and I set it up as Gmail. And then once you've got that set up, pardon me, you can set up mail, calendars, or notes from Gmail. And the best part about it is it just sees all of your calendars. You don't have to, you go in, let's see, there was a weird thing that we had to do, and I wanted to walk through that, because though it was easier, you set everything up for all of your devices now. You don't have to do it one by one. So you go to google.com/sync, just regular google.com/sync, and you go to calendar at the bottom of the screen, and you say sync with a mobile device. And this is where it'll kind of walk you through all of your stuff. And I'm trying to find it now, and their website is coming up really funky. But essentially, you just set it up as Gmail. I turned off mail because I don't want to get that mail. I use a different Google account for my calendar. And so I turned on calendars. I turned off mail and notes, and that's that. Doesn't seem like there's a way to get contacts at least not this way. But otherwise, it's been working great. So, but let's see what they say if we want to sync contacts with a mobile device. I'm not. Their help system is messed up this morning, so I haven't done contacts yet. But for the calendars, it's much simpler. You just go in and do it, and you don't have to go and configure it for all of your devices or individual devices or anything like that anymore. You just sync it up and go. So you're probably going to have to do that too, right, John? Because you're using the Exchange thing on your iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got to go back in and set it up as Gmail. No more Exchange, my friend.
Wait, I thought it would continue working. It was already working.
It will, unless you need to make any changes to it. And there's no the interface to make those changes is no longer accessible.
All right.
which is, you know, but that's their thing, but it's totally fine. And yeah, we've got, in fact, this is a great opportunity to say hello to everybody that has joined us at MacGeekGab.com/stream in our chat room. But, so John Linthicum in the chat room says, Google says you have to use CalDAV, which I believe is what's happening when you sign in as Gmail. I believe it's using CalDAV there, which is a standard, and that's what iCloud uses and MobileMe used prior to that. And it works great. So any thoughts, my friend?
Nope. Everything's working so far.
That's good. I, one of my second tales of woe, we were, well, the tale of woe is that we were at the mall the day after Christmas. I'm still not sure what bit of wisdom compelled us to travel to the mall the day after Christmas, but in any event, we were there. The kids had some gift certificates they wanted to burn up. And as we were leaving, I had, you know, I had my hand in my pocket on my iPhone and we were walking past the Apple store. And it hit me. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. The volume up button on my iPhone 5 is it's always been just janky. You know, it's just funky. It doesn't feel right. It works, but it doesn't feel right. And so I thought, oh, I wonder if I can get them to swap it out. So as I'm walking, you know, kind of across the mall hallway, I pulled up the app, the Apple Store app, and made an appointment for, you know, 10 minutes later because they had a slot open. I thought, perfect. And I went in and checked in. And they said, oh, he looks, we've got you on the schedule in 10 minutes. I said, yeah, I know. And then I went and shot an iCloud backup. You know, I topped off my iCloud backup. It had done it that previous night when I plugged it in, but I did my iCloud backup on their Wi-Fi in there. Guy came out, took a look at the phone. He said, yep, the button's janky. He swapped out the phone. He said, do you have a backup? I said, yep, just topped it off. So he came out, swapped out the phone. And, whole process took all of about 20 minutes, start to finish. And that includes the 10 minutes of waiting. And now I have a new iPhone. Worked great. And I did the restore right there in the store and all was good. One thing I will point out about this, though, I have a lot of apps on my iPhone. I started the restore because I had to do the restore over iCloud because that's where the latest copy of my data was. But if you've ever done this, what happens if you do the restore from iCloud is it then downloads all of your apps from the App Store, which obviously uses bandwidth, but also takes a lot of time because it's coming down from the App Store. And I thought, man, I really would love, you know, now that I've got the backup down from iCloud, I would love to just have it load the apps from iTunes now that I'm home and the thing's still downloading and it was going to download for a day. I have, you know, cause I have a ton of stuff that I test or whatever. And so I plugged it into iTunes and hit sync and it magically kind of took over. And instead of downloading the apps from the store, it just, you know, loaded them directly from iTunes. So let that be a yet another lesson that you can right in the middle of the, you gotta let it do the main restore, but the process is twofold, right? When you do a restore, it pulls the data down. This is true if you do it from iTunes or from iCloud, puts the data on, reboots the phone, then shows you all your apps with little empty progress bars until it can load those. But it doesn't care how it loads those. So if you sync with iTunes, it'll just take over and boom, plow them on there. So all's good in the end. But then I had to go and do the Google thing on my iPhone too. So time to go to Francis, John.
Indeed.
All right. So Francis writes, he has an interesting problem. He says, hey guys, I've been having a problem where I add tracks to iTunes by ripping them from a CD or by importing them, by dragging them in. And though iTunes seems to process them fine, it does not show up in my iTunes library right away. Sometimes it doesn't ever show up, and sometimes they show up in a batch. And he sent us a link to a discussion thread at Apple's discussion boards that indicates that he's not alone. And it's true. You're not alone, Francis. I've heard of this. I haven't seen this problem, but I've heard of it. There's a couple of things though. I mean, the consistent thing that I'm seeing is that many people are able to see the songs eventually, right? So you put them in and they go into like limbo land and then something happens and suddenly they appear in your iTunes library. So that to me screams that there's a cache happening that's getting in the way, and maybe corrupted and not processing the way it should be. So I went on a cache hunt, John, not a geocache hunt, but a computer cache hunt. And, I found the cache in home library caches in a folder called com.apple.itunes. And, anything in theory, anything in a folder named caches, a system organized folder named caches, should be able to be deleted with no problems whatsoever, because that is a cache. It is not data that is unique. It is just data that is being cached so that the app can be more efficient. So I would quit iTunes, and I would actually quit all of your apps, because who knows what else is using this iTunes cache. Go to that folder, home library caches, delete the com.apple.itunes folder, and then restart your Mac. You probably don't need to. You could probably just relaunch iTunes. But again, we don't know what else is using this iTunes cache. Safer to just start from scratch. Reboot your Mac. Once it comes back up, start up iTunes. And that would be one way to fix this. I've heard of other people fixing it by going through the iTunes library rebuild process, which would probably wipe out this cache and start it from scratch. But that's not entirely a fun process, so I would try this cache thing first. Any thoughts on that, my friend?
One thing, yeah. So first I found an article, iTunes, how to recreate your iTunes library and playlists.
Yep.
I wonder if that would apply here.
Yep. That's when I say rebuild it. That's it.
Now, the other thing that occurred to me, Dave, so two things. So one, I think another tool that may help out with this is Onyx. There is a portion of Onyx that will clear out all the system caches. And I think what it's doing is basically deleting those cache directories for you. And as you pointed out, you know, a cache is something that helps an app operate faster with data that it doesn't need to download again, but sometimes that can get screwed up. So
yeah, download or even create, right? I mean, a cache can be used if an app has to go through an arduous process to create some bit of data. The cache can be a nice place to store that, so it doesn't have to go through the arduous process again.
And the other thing that occurred to me, I wonder if this setting would affect this. So if you go into iTunes Preferences, Advanced, and there's a checkbox, copy files to iTunes media folder when adding to library. And wonder if changing that setting would have affected this, because I read up, you can read the help on this, but basically I think what happens is that, yeah, if you don't have that checked, then it'll leave whatever files you import where they are and right. Link to them versus copying them and possibly caching them. So I wonder if having
yeah, maybe. I mean, it's that's a different. I mean, it that's not really a cache at that point, right? Because it's actually copying the entire file just into your iTunes media folder.
Right. But I wonder if it's staging it at some point.
Yeah,
the other
exactly.
thing.
Yeah.
Now, the nice thing about this is that you can change the behavior of what happens when you drag something into iTunes. Either through this checkbox, or the other thing that they suggest is that if you hold down the option key when you're copying stuff into iTunes, it will change the behavior from whatever that box is.
It does the opposite. That's right. Yep.
Right. So just another thought there to, you know, something to consider about your strategy for where you want to store your stuff. If you want to, yeah, keep it where it is or bring it into the iTunes media folder.
Mm-hmm. That your option key trick is something I had to remember the other day, John. For Christmas, Santa brought us a third gen Apple TV, and it's something we've, you know, not ever really obsessed about getting, simply because we started with the TiVo before the Apple TV existed, and we've figured out a way to stream all our movies that we store on the disc station. And I don't like the idea of storing all of my movies in my iTunes library, because I want them on the disk station. I don't want them on my iMac, but we wanted to try streaming a movie from the disk station, you know, to the Apple TV. And it looked great. It, in many ways, it looked better, and the sound was better than we would get from the TiVo. But I had to do the option key trick because I didn't want to copy it to my iMac. I just wanted to, you know, put it in the library so that I could then access that library from the Apple TV. I wish I could, you know, honestly, I wish the Apple TV was jailbreakable so I could put Plex or something on there and just point it directly at the disk station and let it see that library natively. But, you know, Apple doesn't see it that way. They want me to put it all in iTunes, but you know, that's not convenient for me. But the Apple TV is cool. The whole screen sharing thing, you know, the screen mirroring from your iPad or your laptop. It's pretty awesome to be able to, you know, be sitting in the living room and say, hey, check out this thing on YouTube and just put it up on the screen. So that part of it's cool.
Rocking.
You want to talk about, you want to help Russell out here, John?
I think I tried and I failed, but we'll go through it.
Okay.
You have something.
Okay.
Because I think you responded. So, Russell says, or writes, I have a problem that has persisted for about 6 months. When I attempt to repair permissions on the boot drive of my iMac, 24-inch 2007, 4 gigs of RAM running 10.8.2, I get an error. POSIX reports no child process. I've tried running disutility from the recovery partition and from the terminal. The error is followed by permission repair completed. I've scanned the drive with Drive Genius, which found no hardware problems. I have also scanned for viruses with Norton, installed the latest combo updater, and reinstalled the OS from Apple through the recovery partition. It seems that the process of permission repair encounters a file structure that causes an error, but the error message is unhelpful as to the identity or location of the offending files or files. Any idea to how I might solve this? And I offered one idea, and then I think you offered a follow-up idea. So my reply was, it sounds like there's some subtle damage to the file structure. Or maybe not. Well, yeah, subtle. Since it seems everything else is working. Since you have Drive Genius, one thing you may want to try is the rebuild option. So he tried a number of things, but he didn't try rebuild. And I've actually had this help me in the past, is that the Drive Genius rebuild option will detect. The reason I mention is because I've seen it detect damage that other tools do not. And that while it's doing the rebuild, or I guess, you know, the pre-flight before the rebuild, it'll say, oh, yeah, this is screwed up. This doesn't match. That doesn't match. I'm going to rebuild that for you. Not that it really has much to do with permissions, but I figured it couldn't hurt in that the damage may be there causing this weird error. So that was my choice. And but he wrote back and said that that didn't seem to do it.
Huh. And you say I had a great idea about this, John. Is that right?
Because you did. Well, I thought you were suggesting, or maybe it was for another question.
But okay.
I think you may have suggested, you know, our pal FSCK is always a nice tool to, though I don't know if it does more than disutility does.
Yeah, no, it often does less. I don't remember having any grand thoughts on this one. The permissions repair, though, I think you're right. If that's failing, that's indicative of something deeper. Perhaps FSCK from the single user mode would help. But I think your thought of Drive Genius with the rebuild is that's what I would do. But he said it didn't work, huh? That's not good.
Yeah, I mean, lacking that, if all of the things that you tried, which sound like pretty much every tool that I know of, I think what you got to do is, there's just some damage there that can't be fixed. Sometimes that happens. So I would, suggest doing a, full clone,
reformat and come back around. Yeah, I don't think there's
everybody back.
Yeah, I don't think there's hardware damage. I would continue to use that drive, but it sounds, yeah, I agree with you, John, a reformat, not the funnest process, but not very difficult either. Right. Like you said, John, the real trick is make sure you clone that drive first. Otherwise, when you format it, all the data is gone for good. And that's bad. You know, almost in cases like that, I like to have two backups because the clone, while a backup, is now the only source of that data. Right. You know, you clone it. And then if you format that first drive, the clone is now your only source of data. And I hate having the whole concept of backups is to have more than one copy of your data. And if you are intentionally going to wipe out one of your copies, you need to start with three copies of your data. That's just me being safe, but I used to obsess about backups, 20 years ago. Now I really do, because our whole lives are stored on these things. So it's just so important. I think to make sure you've got backups of this stuff. It's so painful when we lose data, or, you know, even if it's not data that is gone forever, if it's stuff you have to recreate, even that, you know, it's so painful. So that's my plea for this morning. Would you agree, John? Multiple backups. Yeah.
And then make a backup of the backup.
Well, yeah, that's the trick. All right. I'm curious, John, if you, this is yet another one of those questions that I don't have a great answer for. Adrian says, my older iMac is running Lion and I'm having some serious problems and I need to wipe the disk. I don't have any data on it that I don't have elsewhere, so data recovery is not a problem. I booted to the recovery partition and nuked the startup disk and reformatted it as a blank hard drive. The problem is that it doesn't seem to want to download a new copy of Lion anymore. I don't have a copy on disk. Can I somehow download a copy of Lion on another Mac, burn it to disk, and then insert it into my iMac? Yes, I do mean that the iMac has Lion, not Mountain Lion. So, the App Store does not have Lion as a download anymore. So you can't, going through normal channels, you aren't going to find it on the store. You may find it if you do some Googling. You may find it if you BitTorrent the copy, or you might be able to go to the Mac to the Apple Store rather and ask at the Genius Bar. They may well have a copy of this that they can put back on there for you. However, I will make another plea. Lion is horrible. It was one of the, like, from a troubleshooting standpoint, we had personally had and heard about from all of you more trouble with OS X Lion than any OS it was like the Windows ME of the Apple world. I think you're going to run into more problems again. And the $30 or whatever it is to upgrade to Mountain Lion, I don't see, and maybe there's a specific reason why you shouldn't upgrade to Mountain Lion, Adrian, but in a general sense, I there's just no reason not to completely get past Lion. I had Lion on this computer here that I podcast on for 2 weeks. I ran Snow Leopard, and then I thought, well, okay, let me try Lion, but I know Mountain Lion's, I think Mountain Lion was even out at the time or about to come out. And I had it on here for 2 weeks. It was the worst 2 weeks ever. It was just ridiculous how bad things were. And then when I put Mountain Lion on, all those problems went away. So there's my plea. Perhaps instead of spending all the time trying to download Lion from BitTorrent, just go get Mountain Lion and your life may be better in the end anyway. Mr. Braun.
I have a solution if you really want to get Lion. Now, one reason.
I thought you might. Yeah, that's good.
Well, I did find something. So it's not easy. Like, for example, I have my podcast machine has Lion on it.
I know.
And actually, Lion is still listed in the App Store. But if I try to download it, it comes up with an error because I think it's there, but it's really not there.
Right.
Comes up and says like error 13, try later. Because I think they yanked it, even though it appears in my list of purchases. But this discussion thread that I found suggests that if you are running a machine, so one, the reason that you may want to run Lion versus something else is your machine is too old. It can't run Mountain Lion. So but from what I read here, if you do call Apple and go through the right channels, you can order it and get a code that will then let you download it from the App Store.
Oh.
So yeah, if you look at this discussion thread, that seems to be the only ways that you call their phone support.
Yep.
So you can't do it through the App Store. I think that's a given that will not, or you can't initiate the purchase. I think you have to call them and then they give you a magic code.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
And that's what it says. Now, the other thing is you could, you know, go to the gray market. You know, they did offer it on a USB stick. And, you know, I poked around and, you know, people who were trying to sell those were selling them for some outrageous amount of money. So or just for fun, whenever, you know, we've given this to, you know, whenever you do download an OS, you know, pull out that, you know, the disk image file from the package and burn it to a disk, which I do. I've done pretty much since they started coming out with the App Store, because I like to have the option of having the OS on a DVD.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. Being proactive about it, for sure. So maybe, you know, John's got a copy. Go visit John.
I think I do, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure I do, too, actually. I keep all that stuff in an archive out on the disk station, which I was talking about before. All right. But maybe, wait a minute. So you still run Lion on your podcast machine, and this is the one mm-hmm. that locks up sporadically and has packet loss and all of this other stuff, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Just pointing out some facts. That's all. I'm not.
I may want to move forward. The only reason is that I like to have something running the prior OS.
Parallels.
Our users. You know, I should set it up in a VM. That's right. Yeah. I can do that. The right hand wave.
No. With Lion and later, so Lion and Mountain Lion, you don't even need the hand wave. Just works in Parallels and VMware. If you want to run Snow Leopard, Google is your friend. And that's all we will say about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Google is your friend with VMware. Parallels, there is no workaround with VMware. I believe that workaround still exists out there. You just got to kind of. You got to jack with it, and I don't have a link, but Google is your friend. All right. Let's see. So speaking of wacky things, Seth has a new router. He says, or has a client. He says, I have a client who has four older Macs running 10.6. One machine is the server and the other three need to connect to the server to run the Office software. The server machine just runs OS X, not OS X server. Recently, their router went on the blink. I replaced the old Linksys with a new Asus router. While the old router with the old router, each machine was able to connect to the server easily and quickly. Since installing the new router, each machine can still connect, but it takes over 60 seconds for the connection to complete using the AFP protocol. Both the old and new router are configured exactly the same way. There's nothing special in the setup. They both set to assign addresses with DHCP with no reservations made. Once connected, the network speed is totally fine. I tried Google and Apple support forums, but no solutions were forthcoming. I tried deleting the global preferences plist as mentioned in one support article, but to no avail. Some other items I read that can cause issues don't seem relevant here. IPv6 is set to off, and the DNS server is set to the DSL modem. I know you guys will have the solution. Well, perhaps. It's odd, for sure. And I say that in a good way, right? Because if I said, oh, yeah, that's totally expected behavior, then you're out of luck, right? But the fact that it's odd is good because it means that there's probably a way to make it work. It sounds like DHCP is working fine. I'm going to assume that. But the way to test that is to unplug your Ethernet cable. Open up system preferences network, right? And click on Ethernet, unplug your Ethernet cable, make sure everything goes blank, and then plug it back in and make sure it comes up very, very, very quickly. Should be within less than 2 seconds, but certainly less than five. You should get, your IP address and subnet mask and router and all that stuff should appear. That's the way to tell that DHCP, which is the thing that assigns your computer its address, that's the way to tell that that's working properly. But I think that is for you. I don't think that's your problem, but it's just good to confirm, and it's good for all of us to know how to confirm. The next thing to test, and I think your problem is related to DNS or domain name system, but let me explain. So the first thing to check is that DNS works in a general sense. So the best way to do that, open up Safari and go to a web page that you are fairly certain no one on the network at all, including on the computer that you're testing from, has visited. It should come up as quickly as it normally would. But that will confirm that DNS is working from the router via the service provider and to the computer, and that whole thing works. Assuming that's a yes as well, and I think it is, because you're not doing anything special there, then it seems like the issue is delays with specifically with the AFP, the Apple File Protocol networking connection. And it might be a DNS delay. In fact, I still think it is. If you're connecting by name to the other computer, and because of the way this new router handles things, it is first looking to external DNS. So let's say, and I'll use my setup here as an example. I have three iMacs. I have iMac, and I named them iMac Studio, iMac Office, iMac House. I can connect to them by their names. And I can go into the AFP thing. I can go to, you know, in the Finder Go menu, connect to server, type in iMac Office, and it finds it immediately. But that's not because of some magic between the computers. It's because my router knows that that computer is called iMac Office, because that's how that router works. When that iMac identifies itself for DHCP, it gives its name, and the router says, I'll remember your name and assign it to your IP address. If your new router does not do that, then what's going to happen, and again, I'll use my setup, if I go to iMac Office, it's going to ask the internet domain name servers, what is iMac Office? And they're probably not going to know, because there's no .com, there's no anything. It's just iMac Office. This is not a fully qualified address, and it's going to time out. And it seems like after it would time out, then maybe the computers will fall back to the Bonjour networking protocol, which is this whole thing where they do sort of do some magic between each other and find each other, and off they go. And it sounds to me like that's exactly what's happening here for you. A way to check and work around that is to put in the IP address of the other computer. So go to, in my case, go to the iMac Office, go to System Preferences Network, check the IP address. And then instead of back to the original computer, instead of saying, AFP:// iMac Office, you type in AFP:// whatever the IP address is, 10.0.0.25. If that connects immediately, then you know for certain that you have some issue with DNS. May just be a function of how this router works. And in that case, maybe you do want to set manual IP addresses, or maybe there is something you can do in this router to set it. iMac Office goes here, and whatever. But it sounds like that's the issue. And again, the easy workaround is to set DHCP reservations, manual IP addresses for everybody, and then just connect the computers with IPs and don't worry about domain names. So that's my thought. Mr. Braun?
That's a good thought.
I like it. I was pretty happy with it. You going to poke holes in it, or are you going to add to it?
Oh, no, I'm just going to add a little bit here. All right, cool. But I think you pretty much got it here. Yeah, I would concur that it's a name lookup issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one thing to keep in mind, AFP operates, it's no longer proprietary. It operates over TCP/IP like anything else. The only thing I'll mention here is that AFP runs over, I think, typically ports 548 and 427. So the only thing is, I don't know why, but, would the router have any reason to get upset about using those ports or not?
Right.
Just something to check, since it is using a different port for file sharing than some other protocols. The place to go, though, I think, and yeah, this... if in the Finder you go to the Go menu, there's a connect to server option.
Yep.
Command K, and you can go there. And like I already look, and now I have a favorites here. And actually, the one favorite I have is the podcasting machine. So I have AFP:// 172.16.1.200/podcast. I'm addressing it by IP rather than name. So this would be the place to try that.
Yep.
Try that trick. Is, input it with the name and then input it with the IP. Because I found, the IP goes straight to the source. No translation. So I think I'm with you on that. That's
Yeah, and that is one thing that will be different from router to router, is how they deal with, whatever. What we're talking about here in terms of the name is, you can go in System Preferences Network, click on, say, Ethernet, if that's how you're connecting. Go to advanced, and you'll see on that first TCP IP tab, it says DHCP client ID. That can, not always, but can be used by the router as an identifier for other machines to find you. It's not mandatory that it does this. I don't even know that it's part of the spec. It probably is like in a footnote somewhere. I could be entirely wrong about that because I'm just speculating. So don't shoot the messenger here. Don't shoot the speculator. But I have seen routers do this, but not all routers do it. So that if that's how you were connecting, and this ASUS router chooses not to, or is not built to build a table of those and assign them to IP addresses or relate them to IP addresses, then it's just not going to work. So that, yeah, that's it. I'm almost certain that that's going to solve your problem, Seth. I hope so.
Yeah. And, well, I think then, it was stated that DHCP reservations are not being used.
That's right. That's what he said. Yeah. But if you're going to use, if you're going to change and just have everybody access the other machines by IP address, then you do want to use DHCP reservations so that you know the IP address isn't going to change.
Yeah. And at least with the Apple product and most others, I would think there are two ways to reserve. One is by, as you stated, client ID, and the other is MAC address.
Yeah. Client ID is something I have not seen on most non-Apple routers. Most of the time, it's just MAC address for the reservations.
Yeah. Well, I guess the reason is you could have somebody, you know, do something dumb and assign the same client ID to two different computers, whereas assigning the same MAC address is a little harder.
Yeah, you've got to go out of your way to screw that up. That's right. Yeah, if you screw that up, you're on your own.
So I prefer MAC address.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's weird. Which,
actually, I was wrestling with that, so I finally replaced my time capsule, and
yep.
And I had a little trauma on my work machine, so brought it home over the weekend, and so I was adding it to my base station, and so set up a DHCP reservation, tried to log into it, you know, it's a nice new Dell with 802.11n and all that, and it said, "Up, oh, I can't connect to it." I'm like, what a piece of junk. And then I realized, oh, wait, that's my problem. Well, I blame Windows and I blame myself. I blame Windows because Windows didn't, the reason it couldn't connect is because I had not put it in the approved MAC address list.
Oh, that's right. You do security by MAC address.
I restrict. So I do DHCP reservations, but I also restrict by MAC address. Now, yes, I know it's not foolproof, but it's a way to slow people down and keep them from getting into your base, is that they have to have or guess the right MAC address. Though in this case, even though I had it as a DHCP reservation, it wasn't in the list of permitted ones. But the Windows, whatever program was trying to connect, didn't realize this. And I'm almost positive that if you do this on a Mac, it's going to say, oh, well, you know, I was going to let you connect, but your MAC address is not in the list of the cool kids, so I'm not going to let you connect.
That's here really it just funny.
Here it just said failed. Whereas I would think there'd be a message coming back from the base saying, I can't talk to you because you're not on the list of people that I'm supposed to talk to.
Yeah, but it that's just not said, how that yep, works.
I failed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But that's weird.
I think it sends some sort of reject message. So while during the negotiation, it should have said at one point, well, no, your MAC address isn't on my list, so go away.
But yeah, but wouldn't that in and of itself be a security hole? Right. Because if someone's trying to hack in and your router sends a message saying, I could let you in if you were on this secret list that I have, you know, now it's no longer security by obscurity, right? You've now told the potential hacker exactly what they have to do to target and thwart this. So perhaps that's the reason they don't do that.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I do is that I don't broadcast the SSID. So you need that piece and then you need, you could get all the pieces. So,
yeah. So that's,
it was just annoying because as it turned out, it was my fault. But for a while, I thought it was a problem on the Windows machine and it wasn't.
Right. What's interesting to me is that you were able to set up a static lease without it telling you, hey, you should also add this MAC address to your allowed list, because otherwise it's not going to work. That I see as a flaw on, this was the time capsule. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. That's a very good point.
Yeah. I mean, it should, especially from Apple, I would expect them to say, hey, you sure you don't want to add them to the allowed list? Because otherwise what you're doing here is a waste of time. Mm-hmm. That's my, It should. I rely on Apple to keep me from doing stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I call them all the time, ask them like how to cook a turkey, and you know, you don't want to burn this and that. That's just what they're. That's what they're. That's the purpose they serve in my life, John.
Mm-hmm. Splendid.
Yes, that's right. All right. Why don't you help us with Louis or Louis? I'm not sure of the pronunciation.
Well, it looks like Louis. Yeah, all right. I'll say Louis. All right. Okay. Hi, guys.
Well, he's from Montreal, so we could be going with the French pronunciation there. But anyway, The question is most important.
All right. Hi, guys. I'm about to receive my new iMac 27-inch and would like to start fresh. I don't mind spending the time. I've been migrating everything for a long time. I think it's time for a clean slate. My plan is, 1, create a new user account using my current account name. 2, install the software I need. 3, migrate my current user data to my new account. Is this the simplest way to start fresh? Can I migrate my data to my new account, or do I need to migrate just my current account and data and then install the software? And my reply was as follows. So first, there is an article that Apple has talking about the migration assistant. And the nice thing is that the migration assistant, I think it may have been in the past, but it is no longer. So in the past, I think it was all or nothing. Now it offers you different levels of what you would like to migrate and of the things that it offers. So, you know, and it so shows you screenshots and all that. There are a number of choices. There are users, applications, and settings. So of the things he should choose, well, I would say 1, applications is out because you're going to be installing those fresh. And I think I'd skip the settings as well, Dave. I don't think that you're going to be losing a lot if you don't migrate the settings.
System. It's computer name and network settings and things like that is, I believe, what we're talking about. We're talking about system-wide settings because all the other settings come with users, right? That's sort of that blanket. You know, all your app settings and prefs and everything come with users.
So I would choose the users category, and then it will list the various users on that machine, and then just bring everything over.
Yeah.
I don't think it really matters if you do that before or after you install the apps. I would probably say, well, I don't know. Would I do it? Would I do the migration before or after?
Before or after setting up a user?
No, before or after installing the apps. So the decision to be made here is, do you want to migrate the data over after installing all your apps or before?
Well, okay, so it riddled me this. And I'm going to show some ignorance here about this because I've only ever done it one way. I've only ever brought stuff in, I think. And of course, now I'm second guessing myself. But I think I've only ever brought stuff in without a user account existing. So having Migration Assistant actually create the new user account on the Mac, can you migrate data in to an existing account? I don't think you can, but I could be very, very wrong on that. Do you know, my friend?
I'm pretty sure you can.
Okay. So I can have a user account set up with some data in there, and then use Migration Assistant to pull more data into that same user account, not into a separate user account. That just seems like a bad idea to me, because you're going to be wiping out or mingling data that may not be meant to mingle. And maybe I'm overthinking this. Maybe it's totally fine and everybody is sitting at home going, oh, Dave, totally bungled this one. And that's fine. But I'm curious, and I'm either missing the boat or not. But I've never done it that way.
Well, let's see. I'm trying to run it now.
Oh, I love this. All right, so we got a real live test going on.
Oh no, no, no. Okay, no, I can't do this live.
Okay, that's too bad.
Well, no, my time. No, I'm not restoring from a. It's not seeing my drive. Yeah, I don't want to start doing this now here.
Yeah. Right. I understand. Yeah. Okay. So I thought you had to. I thought my feeling is, to answer your question, my gut feeling is that you're better off doing Migration Assistant before you do anything else. So get everything you can with or everything you want with Migration Assistant, and then be done with it, and then start setting things up.
Yeah, I mean, the article here says, you know, the instructions refer to Migration Assistant and Setup Assistant. Setup Assistant opens the first time you start the Mac. And then it says here, if you don't use Setup Assistant to transfer information when you first set up your new Mac, you can do it later using Migration Assistant as described below.
Right.
So that's what leads me to believe that you can.
Well, you can, but the question is, I've done that. I've run Migration Assistant manually, but I've always had it create, if I'm pulling in user data, I've had it create a new user account with the migrated data, right? I haven't pulled it into an existing user account. And like I said, just because it doesn't feel like a smart thing to do, but I may be overthinking this. I don't know. Yeah. We're getting a note in the chat room here that says from Luciano Silva's that says, Migration Assistant would moan that you have the same account name and will want you to change the username. So yeah, it's going to put the stuff into a new user account, according to Luciano's experience. And that makes sense to me. You really don't want to have Migration Assistant just kind of brute force mingling your data together. You want to be a part of that process, I think. Very, very deeply so. So I would do Migration Assistant first with whatever you're going to use and then be done with it.
All right.
All right. Moving on to JP. Are we done with
Louis? Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think we are.
Okay, cool. JP says, I just nuke and paved my Mac Pro to get rid of the circle with a slash warning at startup. It worked, but now it's back. Probably as I was copying back some prefs or library files. I have no idea what, though. I see lots of folks have this trouble online, but no one has an answer. I wonder if you did. So what JP is talking about is when you start up your Mac, it begins to start up, and then you get the circle with the slash through it. And essentially what that's telling us is I can't boot the system. Something went terribly wrong with the very, very kind of initial setup of OS X, really with, you know, with the overused phrase, the Unix underpinnings of it. It's something went wrong there. And I'm sure JP is right. It's probably something he copied back in, either some extension or something that's just cratering it. Unfortunately, that message, a circle with a slash through it, is not specific at all. But you can get it more specific, I think. If you reboot and as soon as you hear the chime, hold down Command and V for verbose mode. Essentially what that does is it takes that beautiful kind of pristine gray screen away and lets you see all of the what I'll call Unix gobbledygook flowing by on your screen. But you also get to see where it stops. And that may give you an indication as to what's going on. It's not going to be overly verbose in terms of explaining exactly what you're seeing there. But it should be pretty specific. If you look at the very last line, so it flows from top to bottom and then it starts scrolling off the top of the screen. But the very last line is the most recent thing that happened. So this, the line closest to the bottom of your screen, and it probably will say something like tried to load, you know, this extension. It'll give you the full path of it. And then it'll say failed. And so that should give you an indication. Now you've got to boot with another disk or boot if you can into single user mode. You may or may not be able to even do that, but boot with something, you know, mount that drive in some way and then either remove that extension or replace it with the right one but that's the way to start that troubleshooting process is Command V will get that pretty screen out of the way and you can see things go. You can use Command V anytime you want. You don't have to just do it when you're troubleshooting. If you like seeing all that go, just hold down Command V and you'll see it go. And then, as it gets to the point where it would then start loading either the login screen or the finder, then it'll go graphical and you'll see what you want to see. So it can be fun if you're geeks like us.
And I'm going to offer a couple of things, Dave.
Yeah, go.
All right. And it's funny because actually our own Jeff had an issue with his machine not starting up. So suggested a couple of things. I'm not sure how far he got. But one thing you want to try is the startup manager. And when you boot it, and to get the startup manager, let's see, I got the article here. And I think it's option. It's always option, right? Yeah, option. Okay. So when you boot your machine, if you hold down the option key, rather than booting, I guess, the last device that it felt was good to boot from, it'll show you all devices that are eligible for booting. And they could be hard drives, could be external media, could be maybe even a network volume if you're into that sort of thing. So I'd be curious what shows up there. Now, if the device that you want does not show up, then you're in trouble. Then it's hosed. If you do see it, then I think it may be partially hosed.
Yeah. My guess is he'll see it there because it, you know, it's trying to, well, maybe it's not trying to boot from it. That's a good sign. That's a good point, John. It may not even be trying to boot from it. Yeah.
And the other thing to try, which I think Jeff did try, and then even weirder things happen. But you also, depending on what type of Mac you have, well, if you have a Mac that has a FireWire port, then you can start up the machine in target disk mode, and it may basically makes your Mac into a very expensive FireWire drive.
That's true. Yeah.
And then if you have another machine, then plug it in, and it should show up as a FireWire drive like any other drive, and then you could, you know, scan it for oddness then. So those are always for boot up problems. Two things that I always try is startup manager and target disk mode.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. All right. You want to tell us about, let's do one more question, John. Why don't we do Darren's question? And then, well, we just
Darren's
talked about
was awesome,
right? We just talked about Macs that wouldn't start up. Now let's talk about Macs that won't shut down.
Okay, and this was a two-parter, so I think I had an initial reply, and then you follow up, right?
I
have that in front of you?
I will get it in front of me as you're reading, my friend.
Right. Okay, so Darren wrote in and said, "Hi, guys. I'm the Mac geek in our house, but I'm embarrassed to say I have a problem I can't fix." Don't be embarrassed.
No.
Just don't say you wrote to us. My wife's 2009 13-inch MacBook Pro will not shut down. What? Wow. First we have startup problems, now we have shutdown problems. Now this one I like, though. If you choose shutdown from the Apple menu, it just restarts. Every single time, choosing restart causes it to restart as expected. The only way I found to shut it down is to press and hold the power button, which is not the right way to do it.
Not advisable, that's right. Yeah.
And that you're not doing a lot of cleanup. So definitely do not continue doing that because you will almost certainly screw something up because the system is not doing what it wants to when it shuts down properly as far as writing things back to the disk and all that. I tried booting in safe mode and resetting the PRAM. Worth a shot in desperation. I have also reset the SMC as well as completely let the battery drain. It's annoying because AppleCare ran out 3 months ago. I've not reinstalled the system software yet, as I'm not 100% sure how to do it under Mountain Lion. I'd love some advice. All right. So I had some advice, and then you'll have the follow-up. So first, I'd like to eliminate an issue with the shutdown menu choice. If you press the power button or control eject, if you have both of those keys on your keyboard, you should get a dialog with several choices. Restart, sleep, cancel, shutdown, with shutdown being the default. And I asked what happens if you do this, and you'll tell us in a moment, Dave. He tried that. Second, I'm curious what happens if you go to the terminal, which of course is in Applications Utilities Terminal, and enter. And now you and I suggested different flavors of this. So I asked what happens if you enter sudo space shutdown space dash R, as in rabbit.
Well, or restart is how I remember it. But yes. You know, rabbit works, sure.
Because I think that's what it stands for. Space now and see if the system reboots. Third, I would check the console, which of course is in Applications Utilities Console, and see what is near a message similar to the ones that I pasted in. Because what you will see in the console is when you're shutting down, you should see a shutdown process come up. In my case, it says shutdown, and then it says shutdown time and a big long number, which I think is the number of seconds since whenever.
Yeah.
So you should see that in the console. And then what I do is look, if it even gets to that point, to look around there and see what's preventing it from doing this.
Yeah.
The other thing is that there's also another console message that when you do a boot, so you may want to look around that as well, and it'll show boot log is the process, and it'll say boot underscore time, and then another big old number. So I'm wondering what was seen in the console. And so that is what I had to offer. And then I virtually handed the baton to you, or you grabbed it, Dave, and you ran with it.
That's right. Well, I'm always running. I'm a maniac here. I'm going to tell the story. So Darren did your power button thing, and that, of course, brought down the, brought up the menu, and choosing shutdown from that caused exactly the same response he was getting previously, where it went through the shutdown and then immediately started back up. Doing the terminal command caused the restart, which is what we would have expected, right? Out of that. So thinking back on my, when every time I issue that command, that sudo shutdown dash R now, I'm always really, really hesitant, because sometimes I have to issue this command on remote machines, machines that are very, very far away at our server farm. And while we don't reboot them often, sometimes we do. But, the shutdown command is scary when you don't have access to the power switch. Now, of course, we have admins on site at our co-location facility where they do have access to the power switch, but that takes time. I always want to make sure the machine restarts. So I'm very, very careful not to type sudo shutdown dash H now, because the difference between dash R, which, well, to you, John, is rabbit, to me is restart, dash H means halt to everyone. And if it doesn't mean halt to you, issue the command and see what happens. It will then mean halt to you, because it's going to stop the machine. And if the machine supports it in hardware, turn itself off. If it doesn't support it in hardware, you'll come to the machine and see on the console, it's just sitting there saying system halted, and it's waiting for you to switch the power off. So I asked Darren to issue that command, because with the dash H, to see, my thought is that there's something in power management, or, somewhere in the machine that has told it to start up all the time. And the trick is to clear that out. Now, he's done a lot of clearing out. The one thing he didn't check, and I don't know that this would appear there because the Energy Saver UI is a little weird, but in Energy Saver, you can go in and set a schedule for the machine to start up. Now, if there's something funky about that, then maybe it's just scheduled to start up all the time, or the restart after a power failure thing may very well have been tripped. And I know that going through this kind of shutdown clears that thing. So he tried issuing the shutdown dash H now with sudo in front of it, and it shut his machine down and it didn't turn back on. So this is good news. He then turned his machine back on manually because he wanted to use it, and went to get a console log. And he chose shutdown again to get your console log for you, John. Just shut down from the Apple menu, and lo and behold, the Mac shut down. So my guess is that, yes, there was something, and it probably was that restart automatically after a power failure thing was in some state where it was just assuming that every time it shut down, it hadn't cleared that power failure bit, and doing the shutdown with the dash H actually did clear that bit. And now everything is hunky dory, as we will say. So fun stuff. We like doing this kind of stuff. It's fun.
Well, this is going on. I like this one because, if you throw enough things, right, one of them will stick.
Well, that, I'm so glad you said that. I wasn't thinking about it from this way. That's totally the secret to my success whenever I'm troubleshooting a computer. And it's honestly why I've learned as much as I have. And I'm sure the same is true for you, John, and probably for many of our listeners. And I always used to attribute my success in the consulting business to bullheaded persistence. I am just unwilling to give up. And like you said, John, if you just throw it, now I'm not an idiot about it. I don't just, do things randomly, at least not usually, but sometimes you kind of have to out of desperation. Right. But trying something and trying to be intelligent about, okay, I've tried this, this, and this, let's try that. Even if it seems crazy. And in this case, why would a shutdown from the terminal any different than a shutdown from the Apple menu? Well, actually, in reality, they're very, very different operations. And you don't really want to do the shutdown from the terminal if you don't have to. You want to do the Apple menu because it does some other things. Shutdown from the terminal doesn't let you quit apps. It just sort of, you know, takes the rug out from under things, but still does it in a relatively safe way, certainly relative to flipping the power switch. But yeah, that's it. You're right, John. Throw enough things. Bullheaded. Don't give up until it's solved, which sometimes is a detriment. You know, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I get to solving a problem with the house, it's like, you know, 6 hours have gone by. It's like, you know, I could have paid somebody like, you know, $50 to fix this and would have been a much more efficient use of my time. But sometimes that's not the point, dear.
You know, I got something awesome. I don't know if you got, did you get a card from iFixit?
No, I don't believe I did.
I don't know why I'm on their list, but yeah, but I got a card and it had a thing of stickers in it. For those that don't know, iFixit is the place to go, in my opinion, for learning how to both take apart and reassemble your various Apple.
Yeah, with the second part being more important.
And they also say, and I've also gotten some toolkits and parts from them.
Yeah.
In the past, I think the last thing I got from them was the CMOS battery in my machine died, and they were able to sell me a new one and tell me how to get at it. It's really buried. I think it's under the DVD drive. It's like, yeah, great place for that, guys. Good location. Could you put it anywhere more inconvenient? But they also sent a little panel of stickers, mm-hmm. and it has a whole bunch of stickers, Dave. Maybe I'll send you some. They say, I fixed it. So I'm just going to be running around town and work in the home, just putting little I fixed it stickers on things just to let people know.
You know what would be great is if you help somebody solve like a personal problem that they were having, you just put it on their forehead. That's not good. Sorry. The caffeine is getting to me now. Woo! All right. We had we talked about getting in show 429, which was the last show, as I mentioned earlier. We talked about getting the system audio into QuickTime Recorder, and Andy, who is a friend of mine locally here, listener to Mac Geek Gab, also a sound guy and has done sound for various bands that I've been in many times. In fact, he was out last night helping us out a little bit, had this to say.
Hey guys, it's Andy from UNH, and I was listening to your discussion of how to get system audio into the QuickTime Recorder, and I just wanted to suggest that you're making things massively more complicated than necessary. There are two super easy ways to do this. You got close to one of them when you were talking about going to an external mixer, but you really don't need an external mixer. All you need is a wire. You just need a stereo eighth inch to stereo eighth inch cable from Radio Shack or wherever, and connect the headphone out to the line in. Now, you're not going to hear the audio, but if you know what it's going to do, then it will just route it to where QuickTime can grab it. The other thing I wanted to say is that Soundflower has nothing to do with Audio Hijack Pro. It's actually made by another company, and I can't think of the name of it right now. But in any case, you can get Soundflower without having Audio Hijack Pro. And you don't need Audio Hijack Pro to do this. All you do is set your system audio output to Soundflower, and then again set your QuickTime to listen to Soundflower, and you're all set. Again, you can't hear it, but here there's an easy solution. There's another app called Soundflower Bed, which is a little menu bar icon that lets you take whatever's going through Soundflower and send it someplace else. So you can send your system audio to Soundflower and then use Soundflower Bed to send whatever comes into Soundflower to your speakers. But at the same time, QuickTime can also listen to SoundFlower in order to record. This is where you cut me off.
Thanks, Andy. That's, man, so brilliant. As soon as I heard this message come in, John, and he said, you guys made it more complex than it needed to be, I immediately knew where he was going to go. It's like, it's a freaking wire. That's all you need. It's brilliant. I love it. And you're right. SoundFlower has nothing to do with Audio Hijack Pro, and you can get it. And there's no reason now not to get it from Cycling 74, which are the people that make it. And it is free. There was a period of time when the release of SoundFlower from Cycling 74 did not work with the latest release of OS 10, but the folks at Rogue Amoeba had baked a version in with Audio Hijack Pro that did work with OS 10. They had taken the source code and done some modifications, which they submitted to Cycling 74, but they're, you know, they were out of sync on their releases. So at that point in time, I got into the habit of only using the copy of SoundFlower that came with Audio Hijack Pro, because that way I knew I was getting something that, you know, had been road tested in the way that I knew I was going to need to use it. But it seems like right now, anyway, the releases are consistent and there's no reason not to get it from either one. So thanks, Andy. That's good stuff. Great solution. Hey, John. So I know you like the terminal, right? I think you probably love it as much as I do. And when you're in the terminal, and we've talked about this on the show before, I certainly appreciate using autocomplete. And by autocomplete, I mean, if you're typing a file name or even a path to a folder, you don't have to type out the whole thing. Like, for example, if you're going to your user's home, you know, if you're going to your home documents folder, you would have to type from the terminal, you type CD space slash users with a capital U slash, for me, Dave slash documents. But I don't want to type all that. So I type CD space slash U, and then I hit tab and it fills out the rest of users, because that's the only folder that's named with a U. And then it leaves a slash and I start typing Dave, and I hit tab and it autofills that. And I type like DOC so that it's not downloads, it's documents. I've made it unique. I hit tab and it autofills documents. It's an awesome thing. And most terminal jockeys, as I will call us, use this because it just saves so much time, and it limits the ability of human error, the instance of human error, because you're not trying to type documents and fat fingering it or whatever. It's good stuff. Well, Daniel wrote in and said, you know, in the last couple of shows, we 428 and 429, we've talked about how to get to the library folder on it was Robin's question that we answered twice in 2 weeks, how to get to the library folder on an external drive, even though it's hidden. And we talked about using the Finder's go to folder option, right? So go to the Finder, go to the go menu and choose go to folder. What I never knew, and what Dan pointed out, is that you can do autocomplete right there. You can start typing, you know, slash V and hit tab and volumes will fill in. And then, you know, you go to whatever your hard disk name is. And I can't even remember my hard disk name on this computer. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But it totally works fine. And it's just brilliant. I had no idea. I'm sure this has been here for, you know, iterations over iterations of OS 10, and I've never stumbled onto it. Nobody's ever told me about it. So I was so happy to read Dan's note. So, and if you want to stay on the keyboard, of course, the Finder shortcut for that is Command Shift G. And so you can just pull it right up and, you know, keep your hands on the keyboard and slash and to tab. And you know, it's just like you're at the terminal. So Dan's gift to us that we share with all of you. Thanks, Dan. It's good stuff. Did you have any idea? I assume it works for you, right, John?
Oh, yeah, I just tried it. Yeah. Well, that could save seconds or minutes or hours.
Hours of your life were just saved, John. I'm going to save you. I'm going to share a tip that my wife found out about and shared with me. I'm a big fan of GoodReader on my iPhone and especially on my iPad because I use it to watch movies. Like I said, I don't like to store my movies in iTunes, so I store them elsewhere and I just pump them into GoodReader, and that way I don't have to deal with messing with that. But I also use it to kind of archive off PDFs. It's just, you know, it's kind of a catch-all media library for me. One really cool thing is she was looking up, I think she was looking up some knitting patterns, and she's like, I want to be able to save these. And I said, okay, well, copy the link and from Safari, and then go to Goodreader and you can load the link. And she's like, oh, that's awesome. And the PDF saved in. And then like 20 minutes later, she said, I found a better way. You know how at the top of the, in Safari, the top of the address bar starts with http://, or even https://. I said, yeah. She said, if you have Goodreader installed, go to the address bar and in front of the HTTP, put a G. So either it's going to either say GHTTP:, or GHTTPS:. Hit a G, hit go. That automatically sends the URL to Goodreader. It pulls it in, it downloads it, you're done. So it's awesome. So yet another reason to use Goodreader, which I totally am obsessed with and can't imagine not having I have it on my iPhone. I rarely use it on my iPhone, but I really use it on my iPad. Like I said, it's a good catch-all for media stuff. I wind up reading PDF books in there sometimes. It's good stuff. So we share. Anything else, John, before I see how cold the band is this morning?
I think the sharing's over.
Sharing is coming to an end.
As are many things. Well, one other thing is this year. This is it.
That's right.
We're done.
This is the final Mac Geek Gab of 2012. So 2013, we started this show in 2005. We've been doing it over 7.5 years now. So 2013 will be our 8th year in Mac Geek Gabbing. It's pretty awesome, man. Pretty awesome. Hey, I did want to talk about one thing, and I almost forgot because we were in a roll before, so I deferred this question. Dan, we just talked about Graham wrote in and he said, did I miss receiving a premium gift of some sort? I thought through the fall you mentioned that these would be delivered in late November or December. Just curious. An update to all of you. You did not, Graham. We haven't sent anything out yet. We're delayed a bit due to what I believe is a bug in our tracking system. All the data is there, but it's not automatically updating us when one of you hits that $100 spend level. Obviously, we have all the data. We can manually go through and do it, but we want to make sure we obviously get this right. And Adam and I, to a degree, but mostly Adam, has been working with the vendor on getting this right. You know, it's the first time doing it this way, and we don't want to screw it up. So we are in an intentional now delay on sending these out, just because we got to make sure we get all of you. We don't want to miss people and all of that. So I'm hoping, I think we're pretty close to a resolution on that, and I'm hoping that within the next couple of weeks we'll be able to kind of free that up and out things go. But so the cutoff has not happened yet. We will make that cutoff happen as soon as we are able to, and then start processing everything and send your stuff. So our apologies for the delay, but we want to get it right. And everything else with this system has been working so well that it's obviously a little frustrating, but we want to get it right. So, all right. So I can scratch that off the list. Because if I don't scratch it off the list, then we talk about the question twice. And that's, you know, that gets bad. All right. All of these great people have found ways to contact us. And it's not by accident. It's because we like to tell you how to contact us. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the email address you can use to send in, well, email, screenshots, video if you like, whatever you want. It comes to both John and I, and it's perfect.
Yep, and to make sure you didn't mishear that, it's not feedback, it's feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
That's right, feedback@MacGeekGab.com. Or if you are a premium subscriber, premium@MacGeekGab.com, and those do get prioritized there. You're helping us out by helping us keep the lights on, and that's a good thing. So we prioritize those coming in, but we do try to answer everything. I think lately we've been doing a pretty good job of getting through most everything that comes in. eventually, which is good because it's good. It's good material for the show too. We like to share. If you want to call us, 206-666-GEEK, which is John?
4335.
4335 it is.
And you can also go to Facebook. Facebook.com/ Matt Geekab is our Facebook community with several hundred, I believe, people.
Yeah. We'd like to get that up to several thousand, so come join us.
Thousand? Don't think small. Millions!
That's right. That's right. Sorry. At least tens of thousands.
And there we'll post notices, you know, when the show notes go up, when we're having the session, the live stream.
That's right.
You can post questions there. All right, so Facebook, the phone, the emails. Oh, and the Twitters.
Go.
Of course, people are still using the Twitters. So, the podcast is Matt Geekab. I am John Efron. He is Dave Hamilton. The other he is Pilot Pete. And the publication is Mac Observer.
And I think you said this already, but MacGeekab.com/stream is where we are for this. I believe next week, John, you and I are doing the evening shift, the early evening shift, right? The 5 p.m. on Sunday shift. I'm pulling up Fantastical. Have you, I meant to include this in Cool Stuff Found when we were doing it earlier this month. Fantastical for iPhone came out in December. This is awesome. I had used it and tested it on my Mac, and I liked it because it's got this cool little drop down. But the coolest part about it on the Mac is you can just type in podcast with John at 5 p.m. on Sunday for 2 hours, and boom, it builds the event for you. It's the whole natural language thing. And so they put it on the iPhone, or they made an iPhone app. It's beautiful. It's a glorious app. But it is more than just a little drop down and calendar entry. You have all that stuff. And if your iPhone is capable, you can use voice dictation to do the same natural language kind of dictation thing. And instead of typing it, you can even say podcast with John at 5 p.m. on Friday or Sunday, as the case may be. But it's also a full featured calendar app on the iPhone. It has become my go-to calendar. So Sunday, January 6th, I believe we are on for 5 p.m. And then on Tuesday, the 8th, I head out to where do I head? Oh, Las Vegas for CES. I'll be there for a couple of days and then we're back. So that was a long way of saying 5 p.m. next week. But it's good stuff. I do love this this Fantastical. It just looks so good on the, especially on the iPhone 5. It's nice. Anyway. What else do we have here, John? Now I'm totally screwed up because I got off my game. I want to thank Mike. Are we good to go? I wanted to thank Michael Johnston because he's the one that converts this to AAC for us and for all of you. Is there anything else to go through, John, before we put this one in the can, as it were?
No. Happy New Year for people that observe. What's our calendar called?
The Gregorian calendar.
Gregorian. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
If you're in it, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're into that system, time is running out.
Well, until it starts again.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Let's see. We'll thank Cashfly Hosting because they provide the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes, of course, BB Edit from Barebone Software. Disc Label from Smile. Gazelle to sell all your stuff back to. All your electronics, your iPods, your iPhones, all the stuff that you replaced with the new stuff you got for Christmas or whatever holiday in the winter you choose to celebrate. Crash Plan, of course, for all your backups. As my good friend said, Happy New Year, everybody. Happy New Year, John. And looking forward to yet another year of Mac Geek Gabbing with all of you. Thank you so much for this great year and this great 7 years. So Happy New Year. And of course, don't get caught.
Made up.